Welcome back to the Confessions Podcast, Season 2. This season, we embark on a profoundly important journey, one that brings to light the stories, struggles, and triumphs of Black women living with HIV. In a world where the numbers speak volumes, with thousands of new HIV infections among Black heterosexual and transgender women, it's crucial we listen, learn, and act. Black women's experiences in the HIV epidemic are not just statistics. They are tales of resilience, strength, and hope. This season is dedicated to uplifting their voices, shedding light on the disparities in healthcare, and exploring the courage it takes to live openly and authentically. Join us as we share the courageous stories of six women whose lives and experience offer insight, inspiration, and a call to action for all of us. Welcome to Confessions, Season 2.
My name is Robin Barkins. I'm 39 years old. I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. I was diagnosed with HIV at the age of 15. I grew up in a church. My mom has been going to that same church for over 50 years. All of us been baptized in that same church. We all sung in the choir. You know, we were very close-knit to the church. We did everything with the church. My grandmother, you know, she was the glue that really kept us together. And she always believed that if you did things like sung in the choir, be on the usher board, and have some type of commitment with the church, you'll always stay involved. And you'll stay connected. And my family was very, you know, very big on service and service in the community. My mother, when I was younger, we used to volunteer for the Crescent City Classic for the NOT. That was the New Orleans tracks of the Crescent City Classic. And we used to pass out the waters. I remember I used to pass the runners the waters on my head. And I used to light that. At the end of the races, they used to feed us jambalaya and just playing with the kids and stuff like that. Things were, you know, good. And then, you know, trauma and tragedy to me happened when I was 8. I was molested. And that's when a lot of trauma happened for me. The first set of trauma entered in my life. And when that happened to me, I was kind of confused about my sexuality and what I wanted to do with my life and how I wanted my, like, sexually, because I was confused, you know? And I tried to experiment with being with girls and things like that and, you know, just dibbling, dabbling, trying to find my way. When I was 15, I met a guy. He was real handsome, real cute. I liked the bad boys. He had gold teeth in his mouth. He was handsome, the curly bush. Girl, he was the bad boy. And, you know, we were, you know, having sex or whatever. And he asked me one day, did I wanted to have a threesome? And I was like, yeah, you know, let's do it. So he invited another girl into our space, had sex, we had a threesome. And a few weeks later, I experienced a burning sensation when I went to urinate. And at that time, a friend of mine had to go to the clinic. It just happened just coincidentally. Like my friend, I went to the restroom, experienced this burning sensation, and then a few hours later, I had to go to the clinic with a friend. I'm like, okay, I need to see the doctor because I never went to get a checkup or a women exam. My mother and my aunt always wanted to take me, but they never made it to take me to the clinic. So it just so happened that friend was going, and in the state of Louisiana, if you have a person over 18, they can be signed as your guardian. So my friend was 18 years old, and she signed me up to see the doctor. And when I went in to see the doctor, I told the doctor that I was burning, that I experienced some burning when I urinated. And they gave me a pap smear, and I came back positive for chlamydia. And they gave me something like a capsule to drink, like a little cap. And they said, you just drink this and you don't need to take no more treatment. You'll be okay. And then it was like, you want to take an HIV test? And I'm thinking, okay, I'm cute. I'm sexy. I don't have HIV. He's cute and all this. You know, I'm think I'm untouchable. I'm like, sure, let me take the test. So they gave me a ticket and it was like, call a week later. And when I called, just so happened, I had a guy over there at the house when it was time to get my results. And him and I had unprotected sex the night before, and he was in the bed asleep. And I called to see, text, get my results. And they was like, Ms. Barkins, we need you to come in. So I called back and I tried to change my voice, you know, to see if they would give me my results. They was like, nah, we still need you to come in. And I was like, no, I can't come in. So they came to where I was and they showed me my test results came back positive. Instantly, I was like, I'm gonna die. You know, I refused treatment. She asked me, did I want any treatment? I refused treatment because I just thought my life was over. You know, and I had to figure out a way to cover up my debt because where I'm from, HIV is so much stigma, you know, and miseducation behind HIV. It wasn't even HIV. It was like she got that gangsta, got that magic. You know, it was different names for it. And it was just so stigmatizing. I said, I'm not going out like that. I started using heroin, crack cocaine, you know, taking ecstasy pills and doing everything I could in case I did die. People would say, oh, she died of a drug overdose. She died of drugs because to me that was sufficient enough. I didn't disclose to nobody for like 10 years. I didn't even get treatment for like 10 years. After I found out my HIV diagnosis and I decided that I had to cover up my status, I was like upset with everybody. I was like, F the world, everybody about to get it. You know, I was just mad. I was angry. I was upset, you know, and I was like, F the world, everybody gonna get it. You know, and for me, I lived my life careless. I didn't care about myself. I did a lot of demoralizing things out there because I really thought I was going to die. I did that for 10 years. And once I realized that I wasn't going to die, I said, God, help me. Help me. I'm tired. I'm tired. You know, I'm tired of living the way I'm living. I'm tired of this life. I'm tired of smoking crack. I'm tired of selling my body. I'm tired of everything. You know, my lips swelling up when I hit the pipe. You know, my body smelling. After I take a bath, the smell don't go away. I'm like, something has to give. And that very same night, after I said that prayer that morning, I got picked up by the LA County Sheriff's for a $60,000 warrant I had in Compton for crack cocaine. And that saved my life, you know. And I felt like that was my saving grace because I asked for help. I ain't asked to go to jail, but that was the best thing that could happen for me. You know what I'm saying? And I took it, you know, because that saved my life. And when I went to jail and I went to court, they wanted to send me to prison. And I told the lady, I said, ma'am, I'm a dope fiend. You know, all I know is jail and coming home and smoking crack and getting loaded and selling my body. I said, if I do that, I'm going to die out here. All I'm going to do is you're going to lock me up and put me back on the streets and I'm going to smoke again and go back and I'm going to die. So she looked at my case and they rescheduled my case for a month later. And that's when I really, really went into prayer because I was angry with God for all the things that happened to me. I didn't pray. You know, I hated God because how you could be blessed and how all these things can happen to you, but people molesting me, touching me, hurting me, you know, giving me HIV and all this stuff, and you're happy. I hated God for that. And I had to pray. And I said, you know, God, I'm tired. Like, I'm willing to do whatever you want me to do. Whatever it takes, I don't care. I'm willing to do it. And I just kept it real with God, just like that. It ain't nothing special. None of that. No performance. I say, whatever you want me to do, God, I'm willing to do it. I was just that desperate, you know, because I was dying out there. And the next time I went to court, the lady was like, well, they have a lady that's willing to take your case pro bono, and she willing to come see you within 5 days. And there was a tall white lady came smiling, and I'm like, what the hell? Because I'm like, where I'm from, white people don't help you like that. You know what I'm saying? And try to prevent you from going to jail and stuff. They don't help black people where I'm from. They lock you up, you know, for a long time, and you get out of jail, you on disability, you know, real time. You know, but that lady, she came and she said, I'm here to help you. And I felt the genuineness in her. And she really did. She stuck to her word and she really helped me. And that lady walked me through the whole reentry program. I was eligible for reentry. She got me eligible for the AB 109 program, the women's reentry program. So I entered into the women's reentry program and I was entered into Prototypes Women's Center, where I was able to get treatment, you know, and I was able to just recover and get my advocacy platform started there. I learned, like, if my counselor said no, they say you can write a proposal and take it to the board and other people vote on it if she say no. You know, I just learned how to advocate for myself and just navigate within those systems within that program to get what I needed to get. And it helped me shape to the woman I am today. I was 23 years old when I entered into the program. I was 21 when I moved here from New Orleans, Louisiana, after Hurricane Katrina. My grandmother passed away a few months after Katrina, and just everything just was not the same. It was just a lot of loss, a lot of trauma, a lot of displacement, you know, you know, not knowing what people were. In 2010, Facebook really connected us all together, you know, because we were all displaced. We didn't know if we were living or not, you know, if some of us was alive, because we didn't know. That's how long Katrina hit in 2005. And like 2010, once I got into treatment and started going on passes and able to get access to a phone and the internet for the first time, I was able to find friends. And I was crying, like, I thought you was dead. You had water up to your roof and this and, you know, and it was just like, it was just a lot of ball of emotions, you know, but everybody was all right. I came out here for a better life. I wanted better for myself. My life was destructive in New Orleans, you know. I was living to die. You know, that was where my diagnosis happened at. And I didn't know no other way but a destructive lifestyle, you know. And I felt like coming here and my experience here saved my life. I started using my diagnosis for sympathy to get a hit. But when I got sober and really started doing the work in the 12 steps and really had to make those amends with other people, when it wouldn't harm myself or others, I really had to get honest with myself and another person about my status. And I had to call people and men who I had slept with years ago to say, hey, I had HIV and I knew it. Because when I went into treatment, I got really deep into the work, into that book. You know, the books of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really dived deep into it. And I was serious about it. And I knew in order to get free, I had to go back into my past and I had to make it right. And that was telling my family, because I took the opportunity from my mother to support me through my diagnosis. You know, I took that from her. You know, I didn't allow her to be there for me. You know, I took that away from a lot of people, you know, just based on my ignorance and my thought process due to stigma. I'm in a situation now, right? So I met this guy and we like both vibing and like we feeling each other. But, you know, sex gonna eventually come into play. And that's when a disclosure hit. And he was scared because he don't really know too much about HIV. You'll be surprised how many men don't really know nothing about HIV because they don't talk about it or they don't even pay attention. You know, he was like, I'm scared. You know, I just want to take it real, real slow right now because what you told me and the type of work you do, I'm just nervous because I've never been around that. I said, okay, that's fine. I said, but we are taking it real slow. I said, but let me know if you want to talk so I can see how I can support you. You know, and we just had that conversation and I let him know about self-testing, about the self-testing kits. I let him know his prep options. I told him about U equals U. I gave him a whole educational session. So he told him, give him some time to think about it. So he been coming back. We going out tomorrow. So we've been hanging out. We've been eating, having dinner together, you know, and we just been vibing, you know. It hasn't always been easy, you know, disclosing, because rejection is a real thing too, living with HIV. I had a guy that I met and we really liked each other and he was from Nigeria. And I disclosed to him on our first date about my status. I don't know why, it just came out naturally. because I just felt comfortable like that to just close to him. So he started going with me to my doctor's appointments and everything. We were good, you know. And when it was time to meet his mom and his family, he told me that I couldn't meet them because they believe people with HIV, there's no use for them. And I couldn't meet his family. So we kind of like broke it off. And years later, I reached out to him just to check in because I thought about him. And he ended up with a rare cancer. And he has to take chemotherapy 3 to 4 times a week till this day. We keep in touch. But he has a rare cancer. And I'm like, all that judging you did me. You judged me so bad because of my HIV and didn't want nobody to meet me and your family because they felt like it was no use for me. But you have a rare cancer. You have to go to chemo 3-4 times a week for the rest of your life. So it's like them tables always turn. So you got to be careful how you treat people. My relationship with my family is okay. You know, I have a good relationship with my mom. I have family that I have built over the years. So I have like 20, 30 years worth of family that I created. I have lifelong friends that I've had since growing up in New Orleans. I have friends from elementary school, you know, that we're still connected, you know. That's my family. You know, and I have my really, really close friend whose house I was at when I was diagnosed with HIV. And me and her are really, really close. That's like my big mama. Yeah, I have family. I'm not by myself. But here I have family, too. But I'm like, mostly my babies, my puppies. Yeah, I'm on Bigs Harvey. It's pretty good, but I feel like I want to try and get the shot. What is the cab maneuver? Because I don't really like taking my pills sometimes. And I feel like the shot will work for me because it's like I can go back every 2 months and just get the shot without having to worry about whether I took my meds or not. Because sometimes I do forget and sometimes I don't remember if I took them or not. And I'd be scared to double dose. And I don't take them at all, you know, I don't know if I'll have a reaction. So I feel like I want to do the injectable and see how that works for me. But the Biktarvy is good. It hasn't caused me any side effects or anything. I was the queen of support groups. I stayed in a support group. I stayed in therapy. I stayed with a psychiatrist. I stayed with a sponsor. I stayed in meetings. I even got commitments. I was the cake person. I was the chip person. I was the greeter. I did all that. You know, I did everything to stay connected because I know I didn't want to smoke crack anymore. And I know that I wanted a new life. And I knew it had to take a lot of work. I started treatment from jail when I was incarcerated. So when I started my treatment while I was incarcerated, the first time I went into anaphylaxis because he just picked some stuff off a poster from the wall. The second time I went in there, I gave him a few choice words. And that regimen helped. So it was Narvel, Rietaz, and Truvada. That's when that was that cocktail back in the day. And that helped, and it got me down to undetectable viral load. When I really started treatment, I was like, my T-cells was like at 202, you know? So I had to start treatment right away. Yeah, I started treatment in jail, but while I was in jail, I was connected to LaFan, UCLA LaFan. And they were coming inside of the jails. Miss Maria, she came inside of the jails and she would come visit me. And knew I had HIV or whatever. And they used to come visit me all the time. And her and I would have those talks. And she would tell me her story. She was one of the reasons why I really went to treatment too. Because it took a lot of those women to really share their story. And for me to see them living a different life from what they lived. And I was coming out of that life. And I was like, okay, I could be where they are helping other women. I met Precious while I was in jail because she worked for Center of Health Justice and they were going there to educate women around HIV. And when I seen a Black woman that looked like me openly saying she had HIV and educating other women, I said, I want to follow her. So when I got released from jail and was in treatment and was able to get my passes and go out, I made sure Precious knew me everywhere. I made sure that she knew me. Everybody that I wanted to know that was in the work, I made sure they remember me. I got involved with the task force. I got involved with a lot of organizations because I wanted to learn as much as I could to be the best advocate I can be. Because you remember, I told God I'll do whatever you want me to do. It took a lot of work. It took a lot of work and a lot of influence. So, you know, that word standing on strong shoulders of the ones that came before us, I really have. One of my main accomplishments was able to meet my nieces and nephews for the first time. It was emotional because they were 13, 15, you know, and it just showed me how, you know, all the work I did and put into my organization, Trust, you know, that was my story. To restore, unite, support, and transform, you know, that was based on how, you know, how we can be restored to our best selves and be reunited with our family and our loved ones and our best self. And I was able to meet my nieces. And that's what it's all about, family reunification and righting your wrongs. So I was like, that's one of my biggest accomplishments. And being able to see my great niece march in the parade and just being present and being with my family, that's the biggest accomplishment today for me, is being present. Because I remember it was times where I would just leave and people wouldn't know if I was dead or alive. So present is one of my biggest things. Being able to be independent and hold my own is one of my greatest accomplishments. Founding my nonprofit is another great accomplishment. You know, we still building things out, but that's really one of my great accomplishments as well. I'm a simple person, you know, so I think everything is an accomplishment for me. When I was in treatment, I began to empower myself because I felt like I had a platform and a stage to do it. Like, they allowed me to be this advocate and to educate and educate my sisters. So I had this advocacy board where I would put like HIV stuff, pictures, posters, bulletins around HIV and things like that. I would go out to speaking engagements and, you know, things like that. So that took my advocacy to another level, and just being able to do like HIV ministries in other counties, share my story and people listen. You know, and that kind of freed me, you know, and that allowed me to really disclose, you know, with my partners, because they not only see that I'm just this person that's living with this diagnosis, but I'm helping other people, you know, and you know, the work really helps me and heals me. It's not always easy, but if you feel like writing is another outlet or a good tool, you can write to, you can pray. If you have any type of spiritual tools that you use, you can meditate. But I would say it's always good to talk to another human to be able to express your feelings and your thoughts. Seek some help, seek support is always another way. And we can recover. We can recover and we can live a new life. You know, you just have to be willing to want to live that different life and want better. And I thought I knew everything, and that's not always true. And it's okay to humble yourself and take that information in, you know, because it'll help you one day. It may not apply to you now, but those tools you can keep in your toolbox, and it may apply to you 20 years later. When I got my first apartment, I realized that I wanted to do something to help women. I wanted to do more. So I used my apartment as a little space to have support groups for women. I didn't have money. I was on GR and food stamps in my little Section 8 apartment. I would have meetings once my food stamps were hit. And I would invite all the women over and cook and feed them. And then we would have meetings and support groups. And then I said, well, I have to get a nonprofit. So I'm on a bus tapping my feet, and I was like, to restore, you know, and I just the name just started coming to me, and I was like, that's Trust, you know, and that's how Trust came about. It took me a while. It took a lot of obstacles and the financial hardships to get there, but we managed to get Trust started during the pandemic. But now I'm like, girl, I'm living. It's 24 years in June. You know, I'm like, I'm living, I'm thriving, I'm doing me.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through season 2 of the Confessions podcast. The stories shared by the brave women on our platform are more than just confessions. They are a beacon of hope, a call for understanding, and a plea for change. Until next time, take care and continue to listen, learn, and advocate for women. Stay brave, beautiful, and strong.